Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
An ambulance racing to the scene in Haifa after Hezbollah missiles hit Israel's third largest city for the third time since Hezbollah militants provoked a cross-border battle less than a week ago. Israeli warplanes continued to pummel Lebanon today, but Israel denied reports that one of its fighter jets or helicopters was shot down over Lebanon, saying it could have been a drone. Today also brought the beginnings of a diplomatic effort to end the increasingly violent fighting. A senior United Nations envoy says he will present Israel with what he calls concrete ideas to end the crisis after he meets with Lebanon's prime minister. Meantime, President Bush is making news, not for what he said formally as the G8 summit ended in St. Petersburg, Russia, but for what an open microphone picked up in what was supposed to be a private conversation with British Prime Minister Tony Blair. In that conversation, the president expresses frustration with the UN and disgust with Hezbollah and its Syrian backers. Here's part of that conversation as Bush chews on a roll during lunch.
See, the irony is that what they need to do is get Syria to get Hezbollah to stop doing this shit.
To clarify what the president said, see, the irony is that what they need to do is to get Syria to get Hezbollah to stop doing this bleep, and it's over. Anne Barnard is Middle East correspondent for the Boston Globe. She joins us from Jerusalem for more on the role of Syria. But first, Anne, let's remind listeners, when we spoke to you last week, it was the first time Hezbollah missiles had reached Haifa. In the second strike yesterday, 8 people died there. Were today's attacks fatal?
So far, there isn't word of any casualties in the missile strike in Haifa today, although it caused some dramatic damage, destroying a 3-story building.
What is the feeling about the attempts at diplomacy?
Well, at the moment, the European Union Commissioner Javier Solana is saying that he is pessimistic about the efforts. The problem is that Israel is insisting that it wants to continue fighting until Hezbollah is unable to threaten Israeli towns from southern Lebanon, or until it's weak enough that the Lebanese army can prevent it from doing so. The problem is it's very unclear if the Lebanese army can do that anytime soon, and the United States is backing Israel's right to defend itself and saying that at the moment it's not calling for a ceasefire. So without U.S. support for a ceasefire, there's a bit of a stalemate.
How are Israelis reading the fact that there has been no call for a ceasefire from anyone at the G8 summit? Do they see that as a tacit message to continue to attack Hezbollah in sort of a time frame that's being allowed?
Well, exactly. I think Israelis are actually thrilled. They feel like the world sees that Hezbollah is a disruptive presence in the region, not only for Israel, but for many other Arab states. And it's been actually quite remarkable. Arab states like Saudi Arabia, which very rarely publicly criticizes anyone who is engaged in a fight with Israel, this time had some harsh words for Hezbollah. There's both Israeli and Arab commentators are saying today that it's possible that there could be a split between Hezbollah's two backers, Syria and Iran, if there was a comprehensive settlement, something like Israel agreeing to pull back to the 1967 borders, meaning ending its occupation of the West Bank. This is one of the conditions in an Arab world peace plan that was proposed, ironically, in Beirut. The problem is that some people think this could be a great opportunity because Syria is afraid, just like much of the rest of the Arab world, of a growing Shiite Muslim influence in the region led by Iran and Hezbollah. So maybe Syria could be convinced to join the more moderate side of this equation, except they would demand a price. Syria is not likely to change its stance on Hezbollah without an Israeli pullback to the 1967 borders, but that's something Israel has said they will never do. There are settlements on the eastern side of Jerusalem that most Israelis now consider part of Israel, and those are areas that Palestinians consider a very important part of their future state.
Right. Meanwhile, back to the fighting. You write today about Hezbollah missiles hitting the outskirts of Nazareth. What's the significance of that?
Well, that at the time of the hit, it was the farthest into Israel that missiles had reached. It seems like every day they reach a little bit farther. Israeli officials have warned that Hezbollah may even have some longer-range missiles that they haven't used yet that could even threaten the Tel Aviv coastal area, which is where most Israelis live.
So, Anne Barnard, Prime Minister Ehud Olmert says that Israel will not return to the status quo that existed before Hezbollah guerrillas started this cross-border fighting. We hear that the diplomatic maneuvers that are being attempted include a Hezbollah pullback in exchange for the two soldiers, but it doesn't sound as if a pullback of Hezbollah is going to be enough for Israel.
Well, according to the Lebanese government, Israel relayed two conditions, which were the release of the two soldiers plus pullback 20 miles from the Israeli-Lebanese border. Now, Israel has not confirmed that those were the conditions that it set. Presumably, that would have to include not just a pullout, but also a deployment of Lebanese forces on the border and or a UN monitoring force. Israel also has been leery, traditionally, of getting the UN involved. They don't want the international community to be dictating solutions in the conflict, but in this case, with the rocket barrages so terrifying in the north, they might start to see that as the lesser of two evils.
Anne Barnard, Middle East correspondent for the Boston Globe, speaking to us from Jerusalem. Anne, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And we turn now to Nadim Lotki, Beirut bureau chief for Reuters News Service. And Nadim, in the last few days, Lebanese have seemed split in their reaction to Hezbollah, the South supportive, but other Lebanese very angry at the militant group for taking a unilateral action. How are Lebanese people reacting today on the sixth day of fighting?
Most people are looking towards signs of any movement on the diplomatic front to try and bring this to an end. Over the past 24 hours, Beirut has seen several foreign envoys coming in and flying out. Just in the past few hours, we had a UN team that was sent to Lebanon declare that they have made some promising first step towards brokering something between Lebanon and Israel. I think news of that sort would lift the morale of the Lebanese. But yes, as you say, basically, the Lebanese are divided between those who favor what Hezbollah have done and those who say that Hezbollah does not have the right to unilaterally take such decisions of peace and war. Mm.
Tell us a little bit about the teams that have come in to try to broker some sort of peace agreement. We understand yesterday Lebanese officials said Israel had sent terms of a possible ceasefire through Italian mediators. Those terms included the release of two captured Israeli soldiers, but also a Hezbollah pullback to about 20 miles from the border that Israel and Lebanon share. What are some of the discussions today?
Basically, what the senior Lebanese officials are saying, they're saying that this is only the start, that they are only exploring ideas, exploring means to end the fighting. They say there are no proposals on the table. The Lebanese Prime Minister Fuad Senoura yesterday announced that Israel had relayed via Italy two demands for ending its campaign. One, the release of the two captured soldiers, and the pullback of Hezbollah guerrillas. Today, it seems a UN team sent by Secretary General Kofi Annan has discussed other ideas with Prime Minister Senoura. Among those ideas are ways of trying to convince Israel to move towards a ceasefire. This UN team is going now to Israel to explore further with the Israeli officials the ideas presented in Beirut, and they will fly back to Lebanon. So basically, there is the start of a movement in on the diplomatic front that gives the Lebanese people some hope.
We understand that Britain's Prime Minister Tony Blair and UN Secretary General Kofi Annan also had called for the deployment of international forces to stop Hezbollah. Israel rejected this proposal. How do the Lebanese feel about international forces coming into the area?
Basically, I ask the Lebanese Prime Minister Fuad Senoura about this, and he told me that he's heard about it, but it had not been discussed with the Lebanese authorities. He said that Lebanon will look into that matter when it is presented to it, but he said it should come as part of a package deal. Now, as for the ordinary Lebanese, again, they will follow the same line according to their political allegiances. People who are with Hezbollah or who are sympathizers with Hezbollah or who think Hezbollah is doing the right thing will oppose, while their opponents on the other side of the political spectrum will welcome such a move.
You know, it's funny, not one country at the G8 called for a ceasefire. The tacit message seems to be to Israel to do as much as you can in the time that we are allowing you to stop Hezbollah.
That's exactly the reading of some diplomats here and some political sources. They were really disappointed by the G8 statement, and people who were hoping for a quick fix were disappointed. But as I said before, you know, there is, over the past hour or so, news is emerging that a UN team might have taken the first step towards the breakthrough. It's early days yet. I think we need to wait and see what happens in the next couple of days.
Meanwhile, Nadim, what is the refugee situation like? We understand that perhaps upwards of 25,000 people are pouring into Beirut from the south to escape the shelling there. Israel warned residents of South Lebanon to flee. So where are they going? Where are they staying?
The capital opened up schools to accommodate the refugees fleeing not only South Lebanon, but also the southern suburb. It's Hezbollah's stronghold, and it was the scene of the most devastating Israeli bombing over the past 6 days. So mostly people who don't have relatives are using government schools, even private schools, and going to small gardens and parks, spending the nights there. The Lebanese officials estimate that at this time there are about 100,000 people who have been displaced by the fighting.
What kinds of tensions does this set up, Nadim? Because we understand there are large groups of, let's say, Muslims going into Christian neighborhoods, and there are groups that have had tensions between them that are now being forced together.
Basically, the last time it happened on a large scale, it was back in 1996, where we had, according to official estimates, about 300,000 people fleeing South Lebanon during an Israeli operation to force Hezbollah to stop rocketing Israel. There seemed to be at least a level of solidarity when it comes to Israeli action in Lebanon.
So it sounds as if the city is crowding, but we're understanding that other parts of the country have become like a ghost town, the beaches, etc.?
Yes, of course. Even Beirut, it's not crowded because while people are coming in, others are making their way out further north to Christian mountainous resorts especially. You know, just a week ago, you couldn't really find an empty table at a restaurant in across Beirut or in the downtown area. Just 2 days after the fighting started, we had more than 150,000 tourists, mainly Arab tourists, leave the country.
Nadim Lotki, Reuters Beirut bureau chief, speaking to us from Beirut. Nadim, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Robin. Thank you.
And we'll continue to follow the story for you. But just ahead, relief at NASA as the shuttle discoveries back home. And we'll check in on the largest air show of the year now underway in Britain, where Europe's Airbus tries to get back on track after failing to produce its new 555-seat jumbo plane on time. Much more coming up here and now.
Smoke. There goes the Drogue red, white, and blue parachute at the tail.
Welcome back, Discovery, and congratulations on a great mission, bringing the space station back to a full crew complement.
It's only the second space shuttle flight since the Columbia disaster in 2003, but this morning at 9:14 Eastern Time, the shuttle Discovery touched down at Cape Canaveral. Discovery was launched into space 13 days ago on a mission to deliver supplies and drop off a German astronaut at the International Space Station. Commander Steve Lindsay and five other astronauts now back safely on the ground. We thought we'd check in with Pat Duggins of WMFE Public Radio in Orlando. He was at Kennedy Space Center for the landing. And Pat, a huge sigh of relief?
Well, in a sense it was, yeah. I think that NASA's probably going to be going back and looking at their weather criteria because it was getting a little bit dicey right toward the end of the landing.
We understand it was so cloudy that Lindsay couldn't see the runway until about a minute before he landed there.
Well, not only that, but they also had to change the directions halfway down from orbit. They were originally planning on coming in from the south to the north on the runway, and because of a pop-up storm that appeared out of nowhere just minutes before the touchdown, they had to switch so they landed from the north to the south. So it's a little bit of a drastic change that late into the final approach.
A little nerve-wracking. There are also reports of a leaking power unit on Discovery. Now, of course, NASA says it's hypervigilant, but is there a sense that every safety precaution has been taken, especially in light of the Columbia disaster in 2003?
Well, I think prophetically, astronaut Piers Sellers, who was on this mission, said it best. He said that they went back and they fixed everything they could on the tank. Now there's just everything else that you don't know about. I mean, there are just hundreds of thousands of parts on the shuttle, any one of which possibly could cause a catastrophic failure. So space travel is still a very, very risky business, no matter what NASA does.
Right. Pat, just a couple seconds left. What has NASA planned for the rest of the summer?
Well, if everything goes okay with Discovery as far as its checkout post-landing, they're going to try and get Atlantis off in August for a mission to carry solar panels to the International Space Station. And then in a very rapid turnaround, they're going to try and get Discovery ready again for a December flight, and that would again carry up more solar panels to the station.
Pat Duggins of WMFE Public Radio in Orlando, as always, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, the world's top jet builders are showing off their wares in England today at the Farnborough International Air Show. And one company, Airbus, is hoping to recover from a recent business disaster. Airbus is a European consortium backed by the governments of France, Germany, Britain, and Spain. In June, Airbus revealed that the A380, its much ballyhooed super jumbo jet with a 555-passenger capacity, had some serious technical difficulties. Well, today Airbus unveiled a modified version of another jumbo jet, the A350XWB, or extra wide body. The new model was built in response to criticism by major airlines. Can this plan help Airbus stay in competition with the U.S.-based Boeing company? Joining us from the Farnborough Air Show is Dan Michaels of the Wall Street Journal. And Dan, we know it's pretty noisy there.
And not made by Airbus, an F-16 made by Lockheed, particularly loud fighter plane, is flying overhead right now. The Airbus planes were flying earlier, yeah.
Dan, let me jump in. So, sure. So what was the response to the Airbus A350XWB, or extra wide body?
Boeing, with whom Airbus is competing, says that they have expected Airbus to come back with something more competitive, so they said they've been ready for it and they're fighting for it. But overall, it looks like what Airbus' customers have been asking for, because they complained that the earlier version of the A350, which Airbus first introduced in 2004, basically wasn't wide enough. They wanted a roomier cabin, and that's what Airbus has introduced.
Well, last year, Airbus was actually leading the competition with Boeing with its promise of the super jumbo 555-seat A380. The fact that it had such serious problems, we understand the problem was in the wiring, and that there are 341 miles of wiring. There's been management shakeups in the wake of the discovery of the problems. What's Airbus's future?
Airbus probably will get this sorted out. It's going to cost them a lot of money. They've already said that they figure it'll cost their parent company about $2.5 billion over the next 4 years. So it's a big chunk of change. But it's the kind of thing that they know what the problem is. They're putting more people on it. It'll get sorted out. It's embarrassing. It's expensive. They have had a lot of management problems at their parent company, EADS. They seem to be sorting those out. Coming up with the new A350 was very important. They seem to have done that. They had a lot of things go wrong all at once. They still got a lot to do, but they seem to be addressing all the problems that they face. So now they just have to execute, which is definitely easier said than done.
Right. Well, Dan, even though there are problems on the assembly line for this big 555-seat A380 for Airbus, we understand that plane is taking part in flying trials where you are there. Is that true? Have you seen it?
Yeah. No, it flew this morning, and it's pretty dramatic, because at the air show, when there are passengers on the plane, they fly it much more aggressively than you would ever want to be under the passenger, because it's probably not a whole lot of fun to be under the passenger. But it looks pretty amazing to see the sharp angles at which they fly it. It's a bit off-putting to see a big passenger jet flying almost straight up and then straight down. But it shows what they're capable of doing with this. And it's kind of like watching an elephant dance, because it's an enormous plane, and they were kind of tossing it around the sky.
Have you been on it?
I have been.
What does it
feel like? Yes?
Oh, I'm sorry, I was going to say, what does it feel like inside? Go ahead.
Well, first of all, right now it's very strange because it doesn't have an inside wall. It's kind of like being in a house that's under construction. So there are lots of beams and lots of wires and ventilation ducts and things like that. As a matter of fact, if you saw photographs of it, you might not even be able to tell it was the inside of an airplane. Mm. Inside, you're on one deck at a time, so you don't have a sense that it's a two-deck airplane. It just feels like a very big airplane. But from the outside is where it's really impressive. It's just a very, very large airplane.
Dan Michaels of the Wall Street Journal speaking to us from the very noisy Farnborough Air Show in England. Dan, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And stay with us. We'll hear the debate over stem cell research. That's next. Much more ahead here and now. Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program... Senate and President Bush are on a collision course this week over the highly controversial issue of stem cell research. The Senate is expected to pass a bill expanding federal funding of embryonic stem cell research beyond the research already okayed by the president. The president has vowed to kill that measure by using his legislative veto for the first time since he took office. So will his party's lawmakers then vote to override his veto? Democrats are making stem cell research a major campaign issue in this year's midterm elections, with polls showing that more than 70% of Americans support stem cell research. Well, joining us with more, Gail Chadha, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Welcome, Gail.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And let's remind ourselves, there are actually three stem cell bills being debated. Two would limit stem cell research. One would expand the funding, as we said, beyond the limited amount of research President Bush okayed when he first took office. So tell us first about this bill that would expand funding.
Well, this was passed by the House last May by a vote of 238 to 194 with 50 Republicans. What it does is allow the use of federal funds in research on embryonic stem cell lines that come from surplus embryos from fertilization clinics, but only if the donors have given their consent and aren't paid for the embryos. What it does is basically lift a lid on the limit that President Bush, through an executive order, put on federal funding of stem cell research back in 2001.
And supporters say these are embryos that otherwise would be discarded if they weren't used to help couples get pregnant.
That's right.
And yet people who are against it say it's destroying a life, in effect, or a would-be life.
They're very concerned that this will lead to some kind of fetal farm. That's one of the alternative bills that's considered, where women are paid for eggs, where embryos are created for the purpose of spare parts for human beings, that will lead to a kind of 1984 is the scenario they're painting. I just left a briefing that was kind of a heartbreak that involves little kids reading from Horton Hatch's The Who and talking about putting faces on embryos that might be killed. You know, this is a very emotional issue.
We know that there are Americans, in fact, who are adopting embryos that aren't used at these in vitro clinics.
Well, those were the kids that were there. Mm-hmm. Snowflake babies, they're
mm-hmm.
called.
Mm-hmm. Well, the president has vowed to veto that bill, which would expand the use of these, soon-to-be-discarded embryos from
That's
in
right.
vitro clinics. So the showdown at the OK Corral will come after that. Is there any chance that there are enough lawmakers in the Senate and the House to override that veto?
I was just on a call this morning with Diane DeGette. She's a Democrat from Colorado and one of the House sponsors of this bill. Remember, she needs 52 votes for an override. And she said that she's heard from a number of her colleagues who have regretted their vote against this bill a year ago. Now, people, this is an issue that cuts across party lines. There are many people with family situations that this alternative form of treatment looks like it could be a help for.
In other words, using this material,
to
help rid the world of diabetes. What are some of the illnesses that
Parkinson's, mm-hmm. Possibly even Alzheimer's, spinal cord injuries. Embryonic stem cells started. They started developing this as a potential therapy only since 1998. One of the points that critics make is that there have been yet no human trials using embryonic stem cells, where there have been 72 using other kinds of stem cells from adult stem cells. But those who are supporting embryonic stem cell research says, look, one of the reasons we haven't made more progress is that there are these limits. Right. There are only about 20 lines that can be used. If we lifted that cap, you would see much more productive therapies and cures coming out of it. And it's that hope that makes it such a volatile issue politically.
Well, and you mentioned the adult stem cells, in other words, stem cells other than embryonic stem cells. And
from cord blood,
right,
for example.
And there are two other bills related to stem cell research. One refers to those adult stem cells. Tell us about that.
Well, this is sponsored by Rick Santorum, a Republican from Pennsylvania, very strong anti-abortion conservative, and Arlen Specter, also a Republican from Pennsylvania, but who is an abortion rights moderate. That bill would encourage research into ways to obtain stem cells that have the same properties as embryonic stem cells, they say, without destroying embryos. Critics say it just doesn't change very much. We're doing that now. So it would give people who oppose embryonic stem cells, which many scientists think are much more potentially useful than adult stem cells, it will give them some political cover on this vote, but it just won't change very much.
They'll have something to vote yes on. And that thinking is applied to the third bill as well, which is sponsored by Senators Brownback and Santorum.
Mm-hmm.
It would ban fetal farming or the use by scientists of tissue from embryos created for research. Just a quick thought on that.
Well, these don't exist in any... They don't exist yet. The idea is to preempt them. It's this kind of 1984 bill. We don't want this to develop, and therefore we're going to preempt it. But, again, doesn't exist now, voting for it isn't going to change very much.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that would change very much is the bill that the president is going to veto.
Right. Well, the stem cell debate is already a major campaign issue in the midterm elections. Claire McCaskill, a Democrat challenging Senator Jim Talent in Missouri, gave this week's radio address for the Democratic Party, taking on the president for opposing the first bill we were talking about for expanded funding. Let's listen.
It is hard to understand that the president's first veto in 6 years would amount to saying no to doctors, researchers, patients, and most importantly, families.
Gail Chadwick, how is this issue likely to play out in the fall campaign?
The Democrats think it could be a huge windfall and an unexpected one for them. They're going to start running ads as early as Friday, immediately after the president's veto and the expected attempt to override, basically making the case that the Republicans have been taken over by religious extremists who are blocking potentially useful science. Mm-hmm. And Senator Schumer, for example, said last week that they have internal polls that show that non-evangelical Protestants who have never voted Democratic are so angry about the Terri Schiavo case and about the stem cell issue that they are now suddenly a swing vote for Democrats. So mm-hmm. they're very excited about this, and you're going to see it play out, I think, in a number of key races, Missouri, the case you cited, being probably Exhibit A.
Well, just to counterbalance that, there's another issue that's going to be out there. In the minute we have, Gail, this is the issue of a ban on gay marriage. Lawmakers expected to vote on a constitutional amendment banning gay marriage in the House. This measure fell 11 votes short of passing in the Senate. So how is it expected to do in a vote in the House, and why debate it if the Senate has already killed the measure?
Well, the reason you debate it is because it's a very important issue to many in the Republican Party's core base. And that's you're seeing a lot right now. For example, you'll also see a bill to strip, to deny the federal courts the right to hear challenges to under God in the pledge. That's not going to pass either.
But just to get the debate out there.
Exactly.
Yeah. Gail Chadwick, a congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, thanks so much, as always, for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
And we'll follow the debate. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Ice cream cones, tickets to sporting events. These are just some of the giveaways libraries, schools, and bookstores are offering kids to get them to read over the summer break. But maybe the best incentive is a good book, and we have some great ones to recommend today. Sherry Eskin of the Honan Alston Library in Boston is back with three choices, this time for middle school readers. What's that, Sherry, 5th to 7th grade?
I think this is 6th through 8th.
6th through 8th, so a little older. Well, welcome. Nice to see you again.
You too.
And we want to start off with some nonfiction that you've brought. This is a picture book. It's called Bodies from the Ash, Life and Death in Ancient Pompeii. First, let's hear a little reading from 14-year-old Sam Eftham.
Finally, at about 8 o'clock that morning, a final surge, the largest and most violent, shook the area as the remainder of the volcanic cloud collapsed, crushing the top stories of buildings. Bricks, tiles, stones, and other debris were flown through the town. The last surge deposited 2 more feet of ash and debris on top of the town. By then, there was no one left alive to notice what had happened. When the eruption ended, Pompeii was covered with more than 12 feet of volcanic debris.
This author tends to like macabre themes. His first book was Bodies from the Bog. It details how bogs more or less mummified the bodies of people in Europe. And this book we just heard the reading from, Bodies from the Ash, there's a lot of pictures of, well, you open it up and there they are, bodies in Pompeii. But kids are attracted to this.
Yeah, I mean, I think kids are attracted to death and to some scary things. You learn a lot in this about the process of excavation. And I think what this book does really well, I think the best nonfiction helps you learn about what the book is about, but also helps you think about your life. And I think if you and your family were covered with 12 feet of volcanic ash, what would be left for other people to see hundreds and hundreds and thousands of years later?
That is Bodies from the Ash, Life and Death in Ancient Pompeii by James Deem. Your next selection, I just love this. It's Princess Academy by Shannon Hale. It won a Newbery Honor Book last year. It's the story of a little girl so small she can't work in her dad's quarry digging rocks. And then the king comes searching for a bride for his son, and Cinderella-like, all the girls from her town are sent to these princess academies to see if they can learn to be his wife. It's like chick lit for the younger set.
It is like chick lit, but I think there's so much in it. Girl power sort of stuff, coming of age, and if one of them does get to become the princess, I mean, imagine the wealth that they've never seen living in this little tiny town.
Digging rocks.
Yeah, and they'll get everything in the world, but they'll have to leave the only home that they've ever known.
Dun, dun, dun. Well, Sam Efton's 12-year-old sister Margaret had an opinion of this book. Let's get her review.
It's kind of confusing, but it's mostly exciting, and there are a lot of adjectives, and it's very well written. I would recommend this book for kids.
So that's the opinion of a 12-year-old, but Sherry, you're a librarian, and you also say the writing in the book is outstanding.
The writing is beautiful. It's so lyrical, and that's what Shannon Hale is really known for, is this beautiful, amazing writing.
Well, finally, we have The Last Apprentice, Revenge of the Witch by Joseph Delaney. This is Delaney's first novel. It takes place in a fictional country, follows the life of Tom, the seventh son of a seventh son, which bestows upon him special powers. Special powers. Well, automatically, we like this one. Tom must fight an evil, powerful witch. Now, our producer, Karen Miller-Medson's 13-year-old son, Daniel, read the book. Let's get his review.
I really like that it was very plainly written. It wasn't using fancy words. The plot wasn't too confusing. It was very well thought out. It might be a little scary for kids under 7 or so. But besides that, I think anybody could really read this and enjoy it.
Apparently, the author of the book thought it could be scary, too, because as you look at it in the back flap, it says, warning, not to be read after dark, especially page 148, which I turned right to. I won't give it away. But what do you think? Is it too scary?
No, it is not too scary. It definitely has some horror elements. I think the woodcut illustrations inside really add to that. There is, you know, a sort of elemental battle of evil and good. And it is really amazing how he learns all this supernatural, spiritual stuff.
Well, finally, as we noted, there's so many incentives being offered to get kids to read over the summer. The Boston Public Library has a great one. Red Sox tickets?
Yeah, we do. We have Red Sox tickets. It's called Read Your Way to Fenway. And all you have to do is read 3 books and write about your favorite one, and you could be going to Fenway Park.
I could see parents saying, go read a book right now. Three good tickets.
It's often the fathers who are most interested.
Sherry Eskin with the Honan Alston Library, an annex of the Boston Library here in Boston.
Yeah, we're one of the branches.
And thanks so much for your recommendations.
Thank you.
And have a great summer.
Thanks, you too.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. We're in the dog days of summer. Are you ready for some cool guests? Here now is jazz aficionado James Isaacs joins us in the studio to talk about some artists he says may not be household names, but their music will be welcome in your home. James, welcome.
Hello again, Robin.
And who are we listening to now?
Well, the tune is called The Peacocks, and it's performed by a 21-year-old bassist, vocalist, and composer named Esperanza Spalding, whose first CD is just out on the Iva label. Spalding is 21 years old. She's a high school dropout from Portland, Oregon, but she went back to school. In fact, she went to the Berklee College of Music, and now, a year after graduating Berklee, she is an instructor there. So how about that?
Not bad.
Not bad at all.
What's her CD called?
It's called Hunjo, and it's spelled J-U-N-J-O. This is a piano-based drums trio session on which Esperanza Spalding is joined by two equally talented Cuban-born musicians. The pianist is Aruan Ortiz, and the drummer is Francisco Mela.
How would you characterize the music they make?
Excessively unusual music. You see, for one thing, they like to play in odd meters. Sometimes they stop and start, and sometimes they play in free meter.
Remind us what that is.
Well, it's non-metrically accountable time. You don't snap your fingers when free music is being performed. You just let it absorb you.
Right. And you tell us there are some surprises, musical surprises. What do you mean?
Well, for one thing, I think a lot of the accents that I heard over the course of this album were surprising. The way that suddenly the drummer would throw something in there and the pianist would answer. The pianist, by the way, reminds me very much of Paul Bley, whom I call the pointillistic pianist. And at times, Aruan Ortiz suggests Chick Corea at his most percussive.
Well, that's a compliment.
Yeah.
How about the rest of the sound?
Well, Esperanza Spalding's bass has a very sinewy sound, and her wordless vocalizing has this airy, dreamy quality about it. It's almost as if she's, you know, absent-mindedly singing along with the group, but of course there's absolutely nothing absent-minded about their music. Let me give you an example of what I'm describing. This tune is called Mompuana, and it was composed by Aruan Ortiz, the pianist. Again, it's Esperanza Spalding's trio.
Esperanza Spalding and her trio from her new debut CD, Hunjo. And James, I know the next selection that you have for us sort of changes the groove up a little.
Robin, I want to take you higher, as Sly Stone and his family once sang. This is gospel jazz, and boy, it will absolutely lift you out of your socks. This is not only a CD, it's a DVD, and it's by a pianist named Pete Malinverney, who's based in Brooklyn, New York. He's originally from Niagara Falls. He's a very good straight-ahead jazz player, mostly leading trios and as a solo pianist, but this project marks a new direction for him. It's called Joyful. Now, this is a suite for our 23-voice gospel choir and jazz quintet, and it just makes you feel so good, although some of the music is more contemplative than all-out ebullient.
Well, you say he was a straight-ahead player, so why the shift?
Well, as a child, in fact, Pete Malinverney played music in the Italian Pentecostal Church up in Niagara Falls, New York, and then when he moved to Brooklyn, he reconnected with a friend of his from college, a man named the Reverend Frederick C. Annette. This is the DeVoe Street Baptist Church in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, and Pete Malinverney is the minister of music there. So what he's done is take the texts from King David's great masterpiece, the 150 Psalms. This is the lead selection. It's called Make a Joyful Noise. Listen to those fat chords on piano.
Pentecostal. I'm not sure I'd ever heard of that before.
I hadn't either.
And some Gabriel there is blowing his horn. Who's that?
Joe Magnarelli, and he's part of Pete Malinverney's jazz quintet that backs the singers on Malinverney's superlative new CD and DVD, Joyful.
Teus olhos são duas contas pequeninas, qual duas pedras preciosas que brilham mais que o luar. São eles guias do meu caminho escuro.
Okay, James, now we're hearing your third pick for new summer CDs. What a beautiful voice. Who's that?
That's Rosa Passos and the great cellist Yo-Yo Ma, with whom Rosa Passos has recorded and performed. He has called her voice the most beautiful in the world.
It sounds like a Brazilian voice.
She is, Robin. She is from Salvador in the Brazilian state of Bahia. And she's been called the female João Gilberto and the first lady of bossa nova. Rosa Passos' music, she's also an excellent guitarist, is pure classic bossa nova. No electronic effects, no remixes, just Rosa Passos and her guitar, which she calls Baobab. You know, the way the B.B. King called his Lucille.
All right, okay.
Her new album is on the Telarc label. The title is Rosa. She has co-written six numbers on it. However, the song that we're going to hear, Jardim, was co-written by Karen Ann Zeidel. And when you hear Rosa Passos, it's almost as if you're overhearing her as she sings and plays outside under a starry sky.
A chuva cai inundando o capim do mesmo céu. Vem você, querubim. O tempo vai. Quanto tempo já foi? Ninguém mais.
That's so clean.
It's so beautiful,
clean, yeah.
Yeah.
Rosa Passos from her new CD, Rosa.
On the Telarc label.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, we'll have all of these new CDs at our website so you can check them out.
Yes.
But those were new. We've also got something from James that's old made new.
An old wine in a very new bottle.
Mm-hmm.
It's the romantic poet of the baritone saxophone, Serge Chaloff, the late and indisputably great Serge Chaloff from Boston, Massachusetts. Let's listen to him sing, body and soul. Sing on his horn, that is.
Oh, this is a
heartbreaking.
Heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Tell us about Serge Chaloff. He was born and raised in Boston.
He was. His father was a pianist with the Boston Symphony, and his mother, Madame Margaret Chaloff, was one of the most revered piano teachers. In the 1940s, Chaloff was one of the stars of Woody Herman's band, the famous Four Brothers Band, and he took his cumbersome instrument, the baritone saxophone, and as you heard, he lightened its sound.
Mm-hmm.
He made it almost airy. And this indelible version of Body and Soul has just been reissued on Serge Chaloff's album Boston Blow Up on the Capitol Jazz label. Chaloff died in July 1957. He was just 33 years old, but he did leave us this classic.
So perhaps Serge Chaloff will find a new audience.
Well, I sure hope so.
Here now is jazz aficionado James Isaacs. Thanks for telling us about the music that will help us get through the summer. Good for body and soul.
As always, my pleasure, Robin, and I'll see you soon.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here.